Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
It's The Wonky Show. Universities in Wales are in trouble. We'll get across the why and the what. Tayso has a report out on mental health and the OFS strategy. Is it trying to do too much? It's all coming up.
Because what we certainly need to see is a dialogue between universities that can help with collaboration. That's something that I have asked of them since I was brought into post in September.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to reflect on the news this week, as usual, three terrific guests. At somewhere in Hertfordshire, Andy Westwood is Professor of Public Policy, Government and Business at the University of Manchester. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Jim. My highlight of the week has been booking some trains in Germany that I shall be travelling on in a couple of weeks' time, and that's got me ridiculously excited, so apologies for that.
You're doing a sleeper?
I am doing a sleeper. I'm glad you asked. I've booked a sleeper from Berlin to Brussels and a little pod to live in for about 12 hours. So that's very exciting.
Well, a link to that in the show notes. Now, in London, Emma Maslins is Senior Policy and Research Officer at Amoshi. Emma, your highlight of the week, please.
So the OFS may well be launching their proposed five-year strategy, but Amoshi have just launched ours from 25 to 2030. And I've been enjoying playing the new game our communications officers created to help student services staff find out how our strategy will support them.
Excellent stuff. And in Disley, Livia Scott is Partnerships Coordinator at Wonky. Livia, your highlight of the week, please.
I went to see the new Bridget Jones film yesterday, and that was definitely a highlight when everybody kind of gasped when Leo Woodall took his top off collectively. But other than that, pretty good week.
Extraordinary stuff. I wasn't expecting that. So yes, we start this week with Wales. Redundancies are raining down and Welsh Government is under pressure to step in, Livia.
Over in Wales, the Higher Education Minister, Vicky Howells, has announced a £18.5 million in-year additional capital funding for Welsh universities, but that's for the current academic year. There's also another £500,000 towards Global Wales, which is aimed at supporting universities in their international recruitment and promotional activities, so to encourage more students to study in Wales. This is in the context of universities across Wales announcing various cost-saving measures, both in recent weeks that have kind of been in headlines over in Cardiff and also kind of over the past 18 months. So for example, like historic Lampeter campuses closing, and yesterday Bangor's VC Edmund Burke sending an email to colleagues that met said compulsory redundancies kind of aren't off the table there. And one other thing that the kind of minister, when she's announced this additional set of funding, she has warned that universities that the funding is to try and make things cheaper and more efficient, so to kind of support with estate maintenance and digital projects that would reduce operating costs. But she's also kind of encouraged that universities should consider using their reserves to prevent job losses. Now, she has acknowledged that, you know, not everybody can access all of their reserves that easily. Often, you know, Universities Wales have said these, you know, using reserves is a bit of a one-time thing. A lot of it is tied up in buildings, estate, equipment, etc. So it's kind of not as easy as using, kind of pulling on reserves, saving jobs for kind of another 18 months. And then later down the line, the same financial issues are in place. And it's like, well, what are we supposed to do? We kind of have to then look at redundancies and all of that sort of stuff again. But she's also said she's been talking to Jackie Smith about a UK-wide review of leadership and governance in universities. studies, but it's not quite clear if those things are confirmed and kind of if when they would be happening. So all in all, a lot going on in Wales this week and over the past few weeks. And I guess Welsh Uni is kind of having a lot of the conversations with government. You know, Vicky Howes said she's bringing kind of all the vice chancellors around the table, and that results in action that I think a lot of English universities might be looking over a little jealously at.
Well, fascinating. We've got a clip of Vicky. Here we go.
And if I deal firstly with the issue around the competition and marketing authority rules that you raised there, this is something that I have asked MEDA to look into as a matter of urgency. And you'll see if you read academic articles on this, there's not a straightforward answer at the moment. And there's a different interpretation of the rules from place to place within the UK. And I understand that the competition and marketing authority are actually very keen to clarify these issues for the whole of the UK, not just Wales. And I think that that's really essential, because what we certainly need to see is a dialogue between universities that can help with collaboration. That's something that I have asked of them since I was brought into post in September.
Andy, there's some fascinating politics going on here, isn't there? Because, you know, the sort of crisis facing universities hasn't really kind of captured the same level of political imagination in Westminster, has it?
Well, not yet. I think it's getting there. And I think kind of what's interesting about Wales and this intervention is that they're really a bit of a first mover in policy terms. So, you know, they can see there's a problem, and some of the institutions in Wales that have hit the headlines in the last sort of couple of weeks are ones that have been under some financial pressure for quite a while. So, you know, ministers and the Welsh government have been aware of this, I think, for quite a long time. But they've obviously, in putting together this package, have become quite sensitive to you know, to the wider impact of these job losses and the kind of insecurity of these institutions across Wales. So you know it's not a huge package, but it's something, and it's an indication that kind of the government knows that these institutions are going to need some help. They're acknowledging that the institutions will have to kind of deal with a lot of this from their own perspective, and that includes the kind of the discussion about deploying reserves. But like you say, it's a foretaste, I think, for what other governments in the UK, including England, are thinking about, and sooner or later we'll have to get to a sort of similar public position, i.e., you know, a kind of statement of what they intend to do to help particular institutions that are, you know, close to the edge in not just in redundancies and sort of resizing, but actually just in kind of, you know, financial existence terms. So it's so good for Wales. You know, they've kind of recognised it and started the process of doing something about it. I don't think they're at the end of it yet. And obviously institutions are still working out kind of what else they've got to do. There isn't a huge amount of money on the table, so it doesn't take away all of the pressure, but it's a start.
Emma, I guess one of the interesting things that's going on here is that the decline in international postgraduates, at least from the very high numbers of a couple of years ago, is well understood. But there's a quite significant decline in home student participation in Wales as well, isn't there? And we don't really know why, do we?
No, not really. And I think this is a really interesting, you know, it's brilliant that they're going to inject some more money into getting more students in. But I think it goes back to that well-worn phrase, like, it's not enough to get them in, but it's important to help them continue and progress. Like, we know that in the sector's recognised that for years now. But what seems to be absent here is about what happens next. So we get them in, whether it's international students or otherwise. But what are we going to do? Universities are more than just bricks and mortar. It's about people as well. And if we get them in and it turns out that potentially there's lots of staff redundancy, whether that's academic staff or student support staff, how are we going to support them further? So it doesn't matter how many students you get in, but if you're losing the people that make the institution, that's going to be an issue too.
Yes, and that is tricky, Livia, isn't it? Because although Vicky in that clip there was talking about the Competition and Markets Authority from the point of view of institutional collaboration, you know, presumably if numbers are already declining, you wouldn't have a lot of confidence applying to a Welsh university at this point. That, you know, what you're seeing is what you're going to get, would you?
Well, I know this is the issue, I guess, is that all of this has played out because the kind of Welsh government has took such an interest. It's played out very much kind of in the press, and that, you know, Cardiff have announced that they want to kind of, they're going to have to cut 400 jobs or something like that. And I guess the thing that the interesting bit here is that MEDA is in theory due to kind of issue its learner protection plans by August 2026. So, and the idea there is that they would kind of, when they started consulting, God, I think 5-6 years ago now, was that they would kind of be looking at protecting the learner experience, and that would, I would imagine, include things like modules being closed, courses being shut, you know, all that student protection stuff that OFS in theory protects over in England. And I guess if I was a student either in Wales, a current student now, or a student kind of looking to apply, would I pick between a kind of Welsh and English institution when it, in theory, the things that I'm seeing is that the Welsh institutions are struggling more? I mean, I don't think that's true. I think it's just more in the press. I guess the kind of question here is, what will, if anything, Meta be able to do to kind of enhance some of that learner protection? Will it kind of be better than the student protection plans in England? You know, kind of answering that question around the Competition and Market Authority that is always kind of had a question mark over with the English plans around, you know, what is a material loss and, you know, what happens when something is taught out? I think it would be really interesting to see how Meta is in theory going to be able to address that, if at all.
Yes, interesting. I mean, in the longer term, Andy, one of the things I keep coming back to in my head is, is a lot of this about low recruiting courses, low recruiting modules, low recruiting, you know, pathways and so on, and, you know, just being a bit tougher on those, and perhaps people should have been tougher on those earlier? Or does what's happening here require something more fundamental about kind of structures and the patterns of provision and so on?
I think it's probably the latter. It's more of a fundamental kind of existential thing, and that's not just for universities, it's for the government too. The question is, what do you want from universities? What do you want from the human capital that universities produce? What do you want from the research and development that universities produce and help to apply? And that's a big question for not just the Welsh government, obviously for the English government in this regard, but also kind of governments everywhere, really. And I think the difficulty is, you know, we've got a system, we're working to a system, and this is true in Wales as well as England, that, you know, was constructed in a different way to do different things. It's kind of trying to cope with this new emerging reality. And it's not just the universities. I mean, the minister there referred to the CMA. And of course, the CMA is under pressure because, it's had its chair removed. It's been told, like all the other kind of private regulators, if you like, regulators are kind of private markets like utilities, energy and water and all the rest of it, have been dragged in and hauled over the coals and told to do more to drive economic growth. And in a sense, that's a function of the same thing. And universities are part of that that conversation too. And so are the regulators and funders that sit above them. So I think there's a big, big question about how systems are organized, what the incentives are for institutions, and how kind of governments rethink those. And like I say, with the CMA, with MEDA, with the OFS, all of these organizations are kind of feeling that at the moment and trying to work out, well, how do we need to change what we currently do? And in the case of the OFS and MEDA, what we currently ask universities to do to something that better supports the sort of direction of policy and funding and the sector as a whole kind of in the, in the next sort of 5 to 10 years. So I think it is pretty fundamental. And there's pressure kind of all across the system, not just on kind of individual institutions, but on kind of, you know, the regulators, the funders, the departments that oversee them in different governments to.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
To work out how to get from where we are to there.
Mm. I guess, you know, one of the things that I also keep coming back to is this, you know, this idea that, you know, both institutions and students, you know, and the money that we spend on them have to become more efficient. And, you know, there is at least an argument that says, you know, that puts lots of the wraparound stuff under pressure, you know, the kind of support that we offer students, the kind of wider experiences that we offer students as well. I mean, are you hearing you know, that sense of pressure from your members in terms of the sort of savings reductions that people are having to make, and then, you know, what that potentially means for what we used to call the student experience.
Yeah, definitely. Our members, but in Wales, but more generally across the UK, they're telling us that they're being asked to do more with less, and ultimately, our members are very good at doing as much as they can with as little money as possible. But at the end of the day, you need money for some things. You need money to fund staff posts in order to support your well-being offer. You need people, as I said before, you need people on the ground to be able to support students. You don't want students to walk into an empty university because the money's been spent on other things. So I think it's definitely something that whilst our members are very good at using very little, they still need something. And that's also what a lot of students appreciate. That's like what constitutes the wider student experience. When we talk about the wider student experience, a lot of the things end up falling on student services. And often they're the voices that are perhaps not as represented when it comes to the big kind of strategy or big consultation spaces. I think there's kind of like three C's here. I think Vicky Howell, she talks about collaboration. That's really important. You know, collaboration is vital for the sector to continue and kind of power through what is a really challenging financial time. But clarity, like our members often kind of use us as a way to kind of offer clarity in what's being asked of them, whether that's MEDA or OFS. But like thirdly, you need cash. Like at the end of the day, and you know, whilst we understand, and you know, our membership understands that we're not going to get a magic money tree happening anytime soon and sprinkling all of this money on their services, we do need something.
Yeah. And I guess all of that, you know, in a context of MEDA preparing to sort of publish and consult on this new welfare and wellbeing duty, you know, brings all sorts of conversations into sharp focus. Livia, this thing about collaboration, you know, in my head, you know, MEDA, you know, the Commission for Tertiary Education Research, MEDA was designed to sort of make real and make a bit more explicit collaboration. You know, Wales is Wales, you know, you can collaborate more closely with other universities and FE colleges and so on. But it seems that there are big questions over whether universities can do that, either when they're sort of, you know, making themselves smaller or even just more generally.
Yeah, so I think this is something that has come up over the past few weeks. And I think there is essentially a little bit, I think, in the CMA has looked to kind of clarify this around a misunderstanding about what is and isn't okay in terms of universities collaborating. And one of the kind of reasons for that is it's basically competition law. And essentially competition law, because obviously universities compete for students, for research bids and all that sort of stuff, that in theory they can't, there's some people have kind of interpreted that to mean that, well, they can't collaborate because it kind of,
they can't carve up the customers in the market, I guess.
Yeah. And they kind of not being legally compliant if they do. And I guess the kind of the thing here that I guess MEDA and the CMA are kind of, it would be good to hear from them. And if MEDA could kind of make this a little bit more clear, is around an understanding of kind of where the line is between like collaboration that, you know, promotes competition and delivers things for student benefits or kind of consumers, if you're going to kind of use that word. But also where collaboration would reduce or kind of distort competition, because that is what would kind of make it illegal, essentially, on the kind of CMA side. And I guess I think if that's not understood at the moment, that can basically act as a barrier, I guess, to the kind of collaboration which the government is basically, that Vicky Howell is kind of relying on to alleviate some of this pressure. And I guess that's, I imagine, part of her aims of kind of bringing all the Welsh Vice Chancellors around the table to basically say, like, what collaboration can happen in order to kind of make this stuff work. And I guess that will be the question that MEDA will be kind of trying to unravel over the kind of coming months to see, is collaboration possible? It clearly is. There's you know, loads of kind of case studies across the sector where universities have collaborated in kind of various ways. And I guess time will tell kind of whether Wales is able to manage this. And I guess it will prove as a bit of a case study for the rest of the sector.
I feel a little bit like, you know, kind of MEDA's formation is about 18 months too late. And all sorts of delays. Andy, I guess the other thing that sort of appeared that we spotted this week was, you know, buried in the supplementary budget in Wales, because that's a kind of a formal official process, was a change in the student loan resource budget. Now, what is that? Why does that matter?
Well, it matters because anything that governments borrow to spend on is getting more expensive. And student loans, however you issue them and however you expect them to be repaid, are no different to any other item on the kind of on the government's ledger, if you like. And so, you know, the systems that we currently kind of know and love, whether they're the ones in Wales or England are essentially becoming more expensive. Now, you know, lots of individual students will have said that they're becoming more expensive for me in terms of revising the way that the system works and kind of how long I'm meant to pay back and kind of at what rate and all the rest of it. But it's becoming more expensive for government. So higher education is becoming more expensive to do. And along the way, governments have to revise the costs of that in the budgets that they set out. And I obviously should say that you've explained it much better than I have in your blog on Wonky today, where you've kind of likened it all to a pub named brilliantly the Dickinson Arm, which reminds me a lot. A good friend of all of ours, Nick Barr, used to describe the way that people talked about student loans as pub economic. So obviously you had that buried deep in your psyche when you imagine yourself sitting in a sub-quality Spoons discussing kind of government spending and the cost of borrowing.
A repressed memory from 2009, probably. But Emma, this is a real problem, isn't it? Because, you know, broadly, if students are taking out loans to pay for their education, and those loans have been financed by government borrowing the money, and, you know, the cost of for the government borrowing that money has rocketed up, suddenly, you know, even to stand still, the higher education system looks like it's kind of teetering on the edge. You know, what happens then?
It's a good question. And I don't know if people really know. We're kind of all aware, we keep talking about this really challenging financial sector, but we are all just trying to make do at the moment, because ultimately, I don't know if people really do have the right answers for what's going next. I mean, I started my undergraduate studies in 2012, so I was one of the first kind of cohort. And if I dare look at my student loan now, it makes me balk a bit and I have to quickly close the tab and forget it exists. You know, I think our membership knows that they just have to crack on because we can't do anything else. And I think certainly from our members and a lot of other people, I think we're all kind of having to close our eyes and hope for the best, which is a bit scary, really.
I mean, Livia, look, you know, both universities and, you know, students, I think, you know, you can argue have, at least it's felt like, experienced things getting better each year for a very long time now. You know, more gets done for students, more is offered to students, more is done by universities, more is expected that universities do. It's bloody hard work, isn't it, to suddenly go into reverse there and say, do you know what, we're not going to do X, or we're not going to offer Y, or we're just going to have to poke up with the idea that our dropout rate will increase, or whatever. You know, going into reverse feels very difficult for everybody, including presumably ministers.
Yeah, I mean, it's, when you think about that, that's difficult for a multitude of people. And like, for example, for a university, that's really hard, if particularly when you're so heavily regulated, in England at least, by the OFS on, you know, tracking continuation, completion and kind of graduate outcomes. And if all of a sudden you're kind of having to accept, well, you know, we're going to have more dropouts after, you know, you've had years of basically a government telling you need to make sure students aren't dropping out for a variety of reasons, particularly, you know, for students from kind of a variety of widened access backgrounds. That is, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow. And also, it doesn't feel like the right thing to do. And then I guess on the other end of it is, if you're a student and your expectations, I guess, of all of your educational experiences and that, you know, that school, college and universities, is that there is support available for kind of a variety of things, whether that be mental health support, whether that be kind of support to do extracurricular activities or whatever it is. That's, I think, particularly apparent at universities, because students see, you know, that fees have gone up and students see themselves as paying more. You know, there's an argument about they're actually not paying more and all of that because of various loan thresholds and all of that, but they see themselves as kind of paying more, and therefore, you know, you expect more. Like, if I went to a restaurant and was paying more money, I'd expect a better experience. And I guess it's really difficult, and universities probably can't, for a variety of political reasons, but also, you know, consumer rights reasons, if we're going to go back to that, say, well, actually, yeah, your experience is probably not going to be as good on X, Y, and Z levels because of, we just haven't got the money to do it. And I think that becomes really difficult. And, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about later around kind of student mental health, that is a kind of particular, I guess, difficult precipice, I guess, for this conversation to be at. You know, a lot of students are using universities to kind of supplement gaps in public health systems. And if that kind of support all just gets torn away, there's a lot of kind of, there's danger zones there for, you know, actual health reasons, but then also from a consumer, well, what am I paying for if I can't get X, Y, and Z?
Andy, one of the things I've said in the piece today is it often feels like a bit of a kind of iceberg. You know, you've got the headline tuition fee rate right at the kind of top of the, you know, the top of the tip of the iceberg. Then a bit further down the tip, you've got, you know, the kind of maintenance levels that people get. Then a bit below that, you've got the amount of money that universities get. And then below that, you've got, you know, the terms and conditions of the student loan system. And then below that, you've got all this stuff about the costs of borrowing the money to lend out to students in the first place. And I guess one of the things I was surprised about is, you know, I've read three sector body submissions to the spending review this week, and none of them go below the top of the iceberg.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, and it's a bloody big iceberg. Let's make that clear. That's not a financial term, but I think it kind of may help us when we sort of think about these things. So I mean, you're right in that it's so big, it's so complex, and it exists at so many levels that it's much easier to just kind of work out how are we driving this thing along as we go. And I think that's, you know, that's even the case with ministers. And we've heard in the last couple of weeks from Jackie Smith, including in an interview with UCU and at the launch of a King's pamphlet with David Willetts, that, you know, there's not going to be a major rewiring of the system. There's not going to be the kind of, you know, big kind of amounts of public investment that might come charging over the hill to change or dramatically alter the kind of parameters of the system that we currently live in.
But that relationship with the Treasury, I guess, you know, the relationship, not necessarily between universities and the Treasury, but between DfE and the Treasury, that feels very opaque.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
At this point, and it also feels kind of moderately important that we sort of understand it and we know what the parameters are if we're going to make arguments for more money, at least more money up front, surely.
Yeah. The relationship, as we approach the spending review, the relationship between the DfE and the Treasury is the critical one. And I think kind of, you know, that's true in terms of how we understand the cost of higher education as it's currently configured to the public purse, and obviously the Treasury oversee that. But it's also incredibly important to understand how kind of, you know, the Treasury is, with a spending review, essentially tasked with delivering the government's priorities with as we know, ever more expensive and ever more diminishing kind of fiscal headroom. And so, you know, higher education, as lots of people are currently commenting, is having to fight not just for the marginal pound that the Treasury might have to spend. It's also having to kind of understand, well, where if you've got a bit of cash, where are you best placed to allocate that in order to get the priorities that the government has? And, you know, as lots of people have said over kind of many months, higher education as a whole isn't that high up the list. So, you know, and it's the DfE Treasury conversation kind of skirts around that issue all of the time. There's another part of that, which is, well, parts of higher education, parts of what we do might score better. You know, we heard the Chancellor talk about the importance she's placing on the Oxcam corridor, you know, renewing that vision that kind of first reared its head under kind of previous Conservative governments. So we know that kind of, you know, that's a priority, and that's one bit of the system in both R&D and kind of institutional terms. And there are versions of that across the whole of the sector. You know, should we put more money into higher technical education? Should we put more money into the bits of higher education that support defence? Should we put more money into the bits of the system, whether it's skills or R&D, in the bits that are going to be identified in a kind of more detailed industrial strategy that will come out alongside the spending review? So I think all of that is captured within that conversation between the DfE and Treasury. You know, how do you go from kind of thinking about this big expensive thing that's getting more expensive and the cost of running it, and the cost of doing kind of smaller interventions that might be more affordable and actually might move the dial on the big priority that government's got, which is great. And, you know, we need to sometimes, I think, pop our heads into the kind of treasury worldview, which is what are its priorities and what are the levers it can pull to hopefully get us closer to achieving them.
Well, fascinating stuff. More on the site about all of that as ever. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Johnny Rich. I'm the Chief Executive of the Engineering Professors Council. And engineering is fantastic for growth, for opportunity, and for regional development. But the bad news is the country has a desperate shortage of engineers. The good news is that according to the latest data from UCAS, engineering and technology applications are up 14%. The bad news is there are no places for all these extra wannabe engineers. In my blog, I explore why this is and what's stopping universities from expanding provision. Spoiler alert, if Rachel Reeves wants growth, she's going to have to fund engineering education. In fact, there's a wider lesson here about the mismatch between student demand, higher education supply, and labour market needs.
Now, Tazo and the King's Policy Institute have been crunching the survey data on student mental health. What have they found, Andy?
Well, they've kind of reminded us of some of the issues we've just been talking about. They've reminded us in a really important report that mental health is a growing problem in our sort of current student cohort and the kind of cohorts that are coming into higher education. So in this report, they've identified that kind of nearly one in five students are self-reporting kind of mental health issues. We think that kind of that reads across to being as many as about 300,000 students in the system. The report is saying that those numbers represent a kind of tripling since 2017. They're stating that this is now the biggest reason that students are saying that's making them drop out and leave their studies, more than kind of financial pressures. And we know that because the report points it out for us that mental health is affecting some groups more than others. It's affecting kind of young women slightly more than young men. It's affecting kind of people from LGBTQ plus communities more than kind of other communities. And it's affecting students from poorer areas more than from better off areas. And it's affecting the kind of state educated cohorts more than the privately educated cohorts. So, you know, the report does us a favor, not just in kind of setting out those headline impacts, but also sort of drilling down, saying kind of, well, where are these kind of pressures on students' mental health being kind of most intensely felt? So I think it's a wake-up call on lots of levels for the government, for institutions, and obviously for students themselves.
Emma, one of the things that, you know, the first big recommendation in the report, because, you know, and to some extent, you know, we've seen reports like this before, notwithstanding the fact that some of the findings are still fairly alarming. But one of the, you know, the first recommendation in the report is that policymakers should adopt a public health approach to student mental health. What's Tazo getting at when it says that?
I think more generally it's talking about collaboration, and that collaboration is key for improving practice, not just collaboration in this sense, collaboration with other sector bodies like the NHS and how we can work together institutions, but also if we're thinking more whole institution approach again, that people within an institution can work together to support our students with their mental health. I think there's some really interesting examples where this is already working really well. So not just because Andy's on the podcast, but the Manchester model is really interesting. This joint funded GP system, which is specifically for students in Manchester, which multiple Manchester universities pay into. And as a result, they've found through this model, it's drastically reduced students presenting at A&E. So, you know, there's an example here where the public health approach and this collaborative approach is already working really well. But with the caveat that, you know, this is very expensive and that you need, in order to be able to have this public health approach, what's less kind of mentioned in the report but implied is that you need, if you want the results, you need to invest. I mean, HMPIT, the Higher Education Mental Health Implementation Task Force, is also doing work in the space looking at like NHS collaboration. So I guess in this report, that suggestion of public health approach isn't new, but it just re-emphasises the work that can be done to improve student mental health in the space.
Livia, obviously on our travels around Europe, we've seen some systems which, you know, to all intents and purposes, take stuff like mental health and effectively effectively kind of take it off universities, you know, not massively different to at least the direction of travel in that Manchester project. You know, I guess largely on the basis that health is place-based and there's often three or four providers in a place. You know, are we reaching the limits of this idea that institutions should be responsible for this thing and that different institutions or different structures should be responsible for this thing?
Yeah, I do think there's a question, and there always has been, around kind of mental health and just student support more generally, about to what extent this is a university's responsibility. And I guess what's quite hard is that there actually, I don't think there is, and I could be wrong, but there, I don't think there is an attainment or kind of a warden gap for LGBTQ plus students. And, you know, so it's hard to kind of find the data to see, you know, to what extent are universities kind of directly having an impact on those students. And I guess one of the things that does come up is that in the TASO report, which is a lot of the data is based on kind of 7 years of the student academic experience survey, which just focuses primarily on undergrads, it should be said, is that one positive finding in the study is that over the course of their studies, LGBTQ plus students experience a relative kind of increase in their well-being while at university. And while LGBTQ plus students do present at university with are more likely to say that they've got mental health difficulties kind of when they're starting university versus kind of their straight peers, they are more likely to kind of see an improvement in their mental health. So there is, you know, there's obviously something that universities are doing right. And, you know, that could be by design, that could be by accident. And I guess it's kind of a question of to what extent is it a university's responsibility? And I think that there are things that we can look at in Europe around, you know, kind of place-based stuff and taking, I guess, some of the more directly kind of health stuff away from universities. And I guess, but one thing that I do think that universities can do is, you know, students do pay attention to what is in the news. And I don't want to kind of talk about the US in any way on the podcast this week, because it got a lot of airtime last week. But, you know, students do make decisions about, you know, where this study based on kind of both how an institution and the city that it's in feels. So, you know, the research that you're doing there, you know, the statements that you as an institution or a city makes and the kind of pictures they see in prospectuses, the flags that they might see flying at an institution.
Andy, I mean, you know, you say this is a wake-up call, but, you know, I mean, TASO is fundamentally about, you know, advising universities on what works to kind of intervene to tackle some problems that, you know, students or universities or access and participation kind of face. But on the assumption that this isn't all on universities, I guess one of the things that I often think is when I read a report like this is, does this even end up on Wes Streeting's desk, or does it only end up on Bridget Phillipson's desk? You know, when an MP asks a question in Parliament, do they ask a question about this of Wes Streeting in health questions or Bridget Phillipson in education questions? Does this have, you know, will a response come from other parts of government than the bit of government that is responsible for all the stuff we're talking about in item one?
Yeah, well, yes, yeah, a very, very good question. And, you know, knowing Wes as we all do, one can assume that even if it doesn't land on his desk quite as much as it lands on Bridget, that he'll be aware of this. But it's a classic kind of fault line, and there are many fault lines between many departments in many areas of government policy that we can moan about, and you know, rightly, because students are citizens too. They have as much call on kind of wider public services as they do demands from their particular institutions. But I think what it, strip all that away, what it essentially gets you to is a place, and kind of, you know, Emma mentioned the services in Manchester that are kind of now organised across universities and with bits of the NHS that are more devolved in Greater Manchester. And I think kind of where this sort of gets you to is you can kind of moan about those fault lines and kind of whose desk these different issues land on. But actually, practically, you've got to do something about it. And you've got to kind of get the players in an area. And that includes the kind of local NHS organisations, commissioning organisations, as well as delivery. It includes other institutions. It includes other bits of the public sector, as well as kind of private and kind of, you know, institutions in between, to think about how do we deal with this issue? How do we deal with this issue that is growing? And that's one of the sort of services that this report offers us. And I think kind of there's no substitute for that at the end.
Is devolution a potential piece of scaffolding for this, Andy? Is you know, I mean, obviously it's not just people in Manchester got together. I'm not saying that Andy Burnham personally convened that initial meeting, but, you know, there's something about, you know, what's going on in Manchester, isn't there, that feels like this kind of successful and viable piece of non-Westminster scaffolding. scaffolding for people to do things in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of, mayors have essentially have limited powers in lots of spaces. In health, Greater Manchester has slightly more power than other mayors and other kind of combined authorities across the country. But, we're beginning to see more combined authorities now being created. More mayors will be in office by the end of this parliament. And the importance of place, not just to conversations that, we're having on this podcast about growth and kind of the way we organise different sectors, but also conversations about public service delivery and public service reform. So devolution, I think, is a critical part of the scaffolding. It's been a critical part of the scaffolding in Greater Manchester in the way that it's started to tackle this particular issue. And I don't think, I don't want to kind of overclaim what that's doing, but I think the more that institutions get used to working with each other in any of those environments, the easier it is for them to kind of get round the table and kind of deal with whatever big issue is hitting them. And that might be all sorts of things. It might be, in this case, mental health of young people and students. It might be housing. It might be local growth. It might be kind of environmental change. But the more those institutions are in place, the more they mature and the more the relationships with kind of institutions in that patch that aren't necessarily directly controlled by mayors or the devolution process. It's a level of maturity that allows you to kind of tackle this and lots of other issues in ways that we haven't really thought about tackling before. And I think kind of that unleashing that kind of way of working as that and that kind of way of trying to innovate in stuff is a massively important part of the devolution conversation, I think.
Well, one of the big things we'll be talking about at The Secret Life of Students is student health. Here's some fella to tell us more. Hello, it's Jim from the team here with news of our exciting student experience event in March. UKHE has a great reputation, but as the resource envelope tightens, it's not clear that what's been sold to students as a higher education experience can compensate for high costs, overcrowded facilities, and stressed out academic and support staff. The result? Widespread health and wellbeing issues, stubborn awarding gaps, and the erosion of opportunity as demand for higher education begins to slip. Some say the future lies in a great unbundling, but in truth, reports of the death of the full-time three-year degree have probably been greatly exaggerated. So with a new government, a renewed commitment to access and student success, and a regional regeneration agenda, there's an opportunity to build a different vision for a full-time student experience that acknowledges that students are citizens too. They're passengers, clients, patients, employees, voters, parents, volunteers, and taxpayers, each with their own distinct needs and future potential. So as our unique student experience event returns for its seventh year, we'll try to climb out of the doldrums over the student experience debate, asking the question, what would it take for the UK to offer the world's best student experience? We'll get beyond trying to discern the student interest and work towards an ambitious, positive vision for students' participation in higher education. We'll also spend some time interrogating some of the wicked problems associated with particular groups of students in HE. Disabled students, PGR students, students who live locally or less locally to their campus, and the students whose work-based learning means that even the word student, let alone the policy surrounding them, can seem alien. On the day, we'll round up key findings into the student experience from the past year and launch exciting new findings on the student experience beyond the classroom. It's the essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. That's The Secret Life of Students at the Shaw Theatre in London on the 18th of March. We can't wait to see you there. Tickets and more details on wonky.com. Now, finally this week, OFS has been consulting on its new plan and we're starting to see the sector's responses, Emma.
Yep, so it was the deadline for responses this week to be submitted to the Office for Students as part of their consultation of their post 2025 to 2030 strategy. And Debbie, back in December, published a really good overview on the site of what's being proposed. So the responses are rolling in at the moment and UUK and Girls HE have both published their consultation responses. So some key areas to note are that both UUK and Girls HE suggest to the OFS that they need to be more realistic and what they can achieve, with some recognition that they may wish to deprioritise particular areas. There's also been concern raised that by identifying multiple areas in the wider student interest, it might further expand regulatory burden for providers. And on regulatory burden, the UUK suggests that the OFS should adopt a more transparent cost-benefit methodology to review current and proposed regulation. And then lastly, there's a suggestion that this strategy should be considered as an interim, given the expected announcements on higher education reform later in the summer.
Yeah, there's quite a lot in here, isn't there? And I guess that's part of the critique, Livia, that people are saying that, you know, OFS still hasn't worked out what to stop doing rather than continue doing. But I guess, you know, one of my reflections reading the stuff that's come out so far is that everyone says that, but then they're a bit coy about what exactly it is that they think OFS should drop.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess there's a lot in there. And I think EUK are right in kind of, you know, asking OFS to kind of proceed with caution, particularly given that, you know, the Westminster government are due to kind of announce a kind of review of higher education in some form in kind of the coming months. So to kind of see this strategy as, you know, great, but it's a bit of an interim one because it may have to change if priorities kind of shift and all of that sort of stuff. I do find that it's like, well, what do you want to take off the OFS then? Are we going to take away, you know, they've proposed like a new quality risk register for kind of individual institutions, you know, and leaders saying, well, ill defined and it's not going to kind of achieve the outcomes that it wants. You know, the OFS also is in theory going to start regulating on harassment and sexual misconduct coming from August with E6. Do we want that to stop? No one kind of is saying what they want the OFS to not do. They just want the OFS to kind of stop regulating on as much. And I do think it is worth considering that is, you know, a justified ask, because I think UUK said something like for every institution, they need an extra like 14 staff members to basically keep up with regulatory burden. And I think, you know, that is probably true. And the kind of amount of work that is required of the institutions to kind of keep up with current regulation. And, you know, if that's only going to be added to rather than kind of merged or taken away, that is concerning, particularly in the context of financial pressures. And we know that one of the things that quite a few institutions are doing in order to restructure and kind of rebalance books and that sort of thing is there is quite a few, you know, lower level senior managers or middle managers kind of being pulled out or remits are being expanded. People's kind of portfolios have grown and it's kind of one manager rather than maybe three. You know, that is slightly concerning in terms of who is going to have ownership of this regulation if it does take 14 extra members of staff. You know, who is going to kind of do all of this stuff if it's kind of difficult to do it now, never mind kind of later down the line when finances are probably not going to get any better. And I think there is a kind of conversation to be had around, well, what do you want OFS to not to regulate and to not regulate on? Because nobody seems to want to say out loud, well, we don't really want to have further regulations around kind of student experience stuff, because that would be a bad thing to say out loud. But that does seem to me to be the thing that would make sense to kind of stop regulating on, right? Like that's harder to regulate and takes a lot more manpower. So is that the thing we want to stop regulating on? But nobody wants to say that out loud because that sounds bad.
Yes. And I think this relates to burden, Andy, because when people talk about regulatory burden, in my head, in my, you know, down the Dickinson Arms head, there's a fairly simple split, right? There's, oh my God, they're asking us to send them a thing and write a thing or, you know, submit a thing or supply some data or, you know, whatever. There's that kind of hard burden. But then it seems to me that a hell of a lot of this is OFS saying, well, obviously your courses should be up to date. And obviously you should, you know, make sure that students can report harassment and sexual misconduct and so on. And it feels like a lot of the so-called burden is just the regulator describing reasonable things that reasonable people think should exist in all universities. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, I don't always have the greatest amount of sympathy for the Office for Students, but at this particular moment in time, I do. And it's, you know, I mean, it's just really hard to write a five-year strategy when you don't really know what the government's going to do in not just in higher education, but kind of across R&D, across, you know, further education and all sorts of other bits of the sort of public realm, as well as the sort of search for growth. You know, you've got a temporary chair, so you're going to get a new permanent chair at some point soon, and they're going to have a view. So it's really hard to write a strategy. It's really hard to comment on a strategy. Now, you know, when they started this process, they might have reasonably expected, you know, more clarity on some of those views and kind of plans from government than they've ended up getting. But we are where we are. And I think kind of the discussion about kind of what OFS has done and kind of, you know, that regulatory burden associated with it is one part of this. And then there's a sense that, you know, there's going to be a new OFS and the strategy sort of points to kind of some of the things that it will kind of concentrate on. And obviously we know about kind of financial health and one or two of those areas that government is keen on, more collaboration, a little bit less competition. So it's feeling its way towards those particular things. But what we've kind of currently got is too much of both. You know, we've still got kind of the old OFS and kind of what it's been set up to do, and the sort of beginnings of a sense of what a new kind of revamped OFS is going to have to kind of concentrate on. The problem we have is that that we tend to kind of end up doing both, and so we continue with the approach that originally began with sort of the Joe Johnson reforms, and before that the kind of the reforms associated with David Willetts, and then we just add on a whole bunch of new things that the OFS is going to have to do because Bridget Phillipson and Jackie Smith and others in government ask it to do those things. And it kind of reminds me, there's a great blog today. It's not on Wonky, so don't rule this out of scope, but Paul Greatrix has written a great blog today which talks about that regulatory burden. He also reminds us of Alex Usher when he came to Wonky's kind of festival last year and talked about how Canada does regulation. And he says, Canada doesn't have a REF, doesn't have a TEF, doesn't have a KEP, doesn't have an OFS, and seems to do okay. So, we can think quite radically about how we choose to sort of do all of these things. But whatever we choose to do, it's quite hard to do it whilst government is still essentially trying to work out not just what it wants to do, but as our discussion about kind of Wales has already shown, the amount of resource it might have in order to kind of drive those changes. So it's just a really, really hard time to write a five-year strategy when that's the context that you work in.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Andy, Emma, Livia, Michael Salmon, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.